With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
It's really disturbing to me when I go to a professional tennis tournament and it's sponsored by one of these betting sites that I know my social media traffic is coming from. After I take a bad loss, that's a little bit unsettling to me sometimes. I think that sends the wrong message. It's like, hey, participate in this thing that's making people so angry at their player, at our players, that you know they're abusing them online.
Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It's this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast, Beyond the Baseline. This week, we have a WTA guest. It's Nicole Gibbs. She just got done practicing in Carson. We made her pull over to the side of the road like an LAPD officer, like Chips, because of bad audio quality. But we got her looped in, and she was terrific. We talked about all sorts of topics. If you follow her on Twitter, you know a bit about some of her extra tennis interests and activities. Not a Donald Trump fan, Nicole Gibbs. We talk a little bit about that. Nice conversation. So I'm going to tell our trusty producer, Jamie Lasanti, to press the right buttons. Let's put her on right now. Here's Nicole Gibbs. It is December 5th. You got four more weeks, three and a half more weeks. What's your offseason been like?
Yeah, I got a little bit of a late start on the offseason. I played pretty much until the end of November, but I was able to kind of take a week off during Necker Cup the week before the Hawaii WTA at the end of the year. So I kind of treated Hawaii as my first week of really intensive training. So I just completed my second week. I've been spending a lot of time in the gym. This is my second week of two sessions in the gym per day and one session of tennis. So I'm just really trying to get my fitness base strong and, make sure I'm keeping my timing and working on the right things on the court.
You did Necker Cup and Hawaii.
Yeah, I know.
That's a good
not
double.
Tough, right?
And
not bad. Island hopping.
That wasn't even your off season. What, for those who don't know, how do you describe Necker Cup?
It's a little bit tough to describe if you haven't been to the event. It's pretty phenomenal experience. Just basically a bunch of tennis pros hanging out with a bunch of people who love tennis on a private island with Sir Richard Branson. So it was a really, really incredible experience. And I'm very thankful to have been invited. And I'm hoping that the invites will keep rolling in the coming years.
How'd you play?
I did not fare so well in the actual Necker Cup. It was not my best tennis, but I think I was enjoying the other elements of the island, like kite surfing and sailing, a little bit more than the actual tennis at times.
That should be a mandatory event on the WTA calendar, I'm thinking.
Yeah, no, I'm not against that.
I was thinking it was a year ago that you wrote your famous Facebook post. That was like this time last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, my boyfriend actually asked me a couple of days ago. He was like, so are you going to write something recapping your year?
Your boyfriend's preempting my questions. You going to write something recapping your year?
I don't know whether I am or not. I definitely would want it to be a really authentic feeling thing. I don't want it to be I wrote one last year, so I should write something this year, because that's not, it wasn't contrived last year. It was just how I was feeling at the time. So I don't know that I necessarily will, but I do want to get writing again. I haven't been doing my blogs with the WTA. I've been tanking, just been busy outside of that. So I haven't taken the time to really work on the writing stuff, but that's something I really want to get back into and kind of push myself to really keep developing.
For those who don't know, your post last year was, I don't have it in front of me, but essentially it was, I get knocked down, I get up again. Would that be accurate?
Yeah. In summary.
And you had a great, you know, and you had a nice year. You had a very nice first 90 days of the year after after posting that. Is that correlation or causation? I mean, is it too simplistic to say the response you got from that post really motivated you?
Yeah, I think there were a number of things going on. I think a lot of my optimism at the end of last year stemmed from the fact that I had just started a really, really positive and productive coaching relationship with my coach, Roger Smith. So I think he had already given me that spark to really pick myself up and, you know, turn things around and kind of change the downward momentum that I had been experiencing early in 2015. So I think the post was kind of in reference to like all of those things happening and then me finding a little bit of hope at the end of the year and playing a little bit better and really feeling like I was in control of, you know, not just my game, but kind of my life again, which was a really powerful feeling for me. And I think that carried over very well into the early part of my 2016 season. You know, after the first few months, it was a little bit tricky for me because I sprained my hand my very first week on clay in Madrid. And that really set me back. It made Europe a wasted few weeks in terms of my career. And then when I came back to the hard courts, it just took me a while to get going with my confidence again. So, you know, I'm just really hoping for a healthy and productive 2017, but I definitely, you know, I'm very optimistic about what I know I can do in light of my first few months in 2016.
Your hand, the hand sprain is not an injury we hear very frequently. How did that was your dominant hand, your right hand?
Yeah, it was on my right hand. It was just really unlucky. I was practicing the day after my match in Madrid. I lost a tight one to a girl who made the semis that week out of qualies or maybe quarters. So it was a good match, and I was practicing the next day, and I was at an off-site location, and the clay just wasn't up to the same quality that the main site was, and so my foot just drove straight into the clay when I was trying to go for a slice backhand, and I fell really awkwardly and landed on my hand. And I finished the practice. I did like another hour or so on it, but I was like, this doesn't feel right. And it just kind of got worse over the next month or two. And so I was playing through a lot of pain, both in Roland Garros and in Wimbledon, and had to rely on cortisone to even be able to show up at the grass court events. So it was just a little bit of an uphill battle during that time, really unlucky. I was kind of like joking with myself, you know, it's tough to, you know, get up and go practice the day after a tough loss. So I was like, well, maybe I just should have tanked, you know, and then I wouldn't have been injured. But that's how it goes sometimes.
There's no tanking in tennis. If you the injury notwithstanding, you feel how about your 2016?
Yeah, I mean, I have really mixed feelings. I obviously started out pretty strong. I felt like I was growing as a player at a really exponential rate. And then a combination of not being comfortable on surfaces over in Europe and the hand sprain really kind of slowed my roll. And I think I lost a little bit of that confidence and belief that I had early in the year. So it was a mixed bag. It's definitely something that I feel like I can learn from. My coach and I are making some, I think, really important changes both in my game and my equipment this year. I changed rackets within Wilson to something that I think will help my game style a lot more. I'll be getting easier power. And then also we're budgeting, you know, a week or two prior to the clay season to go train in Spain, which I think will be incredible for me to learn not to fall over and sprain my hand on clay.
Watch out for that hand sprain. Are you is this done independently or is this done through USTA?
Is what?
The trip to Spain. Is that something you two arranged the two of you?
They have a relationship with BTT over there, which is who I think we're planning to go train with, if that works out. So it's sort of USTA affiliated, but it'll just be me and Roger going.
You attended the cult known as Stanford. Can I ask you, college tennis, do you have regrets? I mean, you look back on that, and I know you had a wonderful time at school, but is that something that you think about in the context of your career? Do you wish you had turn pro when you were 17, 18? Are you happy with how you played your hand?
Oh, my gosh, not at all. Zero regrets about going to Stanford. If anything, I'm a little bit bummed that I don't already have my degree in hand. I think that was one of the best decisions I've ever made for myself. At the time I went to school, I had actually skipped 10th grade with the idea being that I would leave high school a year early and take a year in between high school and college to see if I wanted to make it on tour. But when I was 17, I just felt like my body wasn't developed enough. I wasn't going deep enough in tournaments consistently. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go to Stanford a year early. So by the time I came out after 3 years, I was only 20 years old. And I feel like that was the perfect timing for me in terms of launching my career. And I don't think I could have been particularly effective on tour much earlier than that. Maybe 19, but definitely not at 17 when I first went.
All right, let me put this to you another way. I can't figure out for the life of me why a player with an opportunity to play college tennis for a year or two wouldn't take advantage of that. You can always go pro after a year in some cases. After 2 years, you can go back and get your degree. You've got something to fall back on. You've got college experience. You're playing at Stanford, so it's not like you're hitting against the wall. You're still getting good practice. Can you take me through the process, a thought process that you did not engage in? But I can't figure out why anybody wouldn't play college tennis, especially with careers extending and starting so late now.
Yeah,
I'm asking
really
you to defend something you didn't
about it.
Do, but, you know, sorry, go ahead.
Sorry.
No, I'm asking you to defend something that you did not do, so I realize that's absurd. But I can't figure out for the life of me why you would just go right to the Pro Tour.
Yeah, I think things have changed a little bit since I made the decision. I think it was a little bit perhaps more unusual to go to school for a year or two when I did it, just because there was that sentiment that as a woman you would be peaking at 22, 23 years old still. It was just the very beginning of that transition of seeing players in their late 20s and even sometimes in their early 30s really peaking on tour. So I think oftentimes people kind of felt that they had a really short time frame in order to really establish themselves on tour. And so there was this like external pressure of, you know what, I really need to get out there and I'm not a serious tennis player if I go to college, was kind of the stigma around it. And that's actually something I battled a lot in my time, you know, going through juniors at an elite level was, is this girl really serious about her tennis because she keeps saying that she wants to go to college? I think that stigma has kind of lifted a little bit. So I think it's different now. But I think at the time, that's why a lot of players were opting to go pro, is the feeling of it would be like giving up on my tennis career or something if I went to college. I never really agreed with that, but I think there was that external pressure. Now I think people are tending to make less externally motivated decisions. I think you have a couple exceptions of like a Cece Bellows or a Kayla Day who have had, you know, a phenomenal amount of success on tour prior to age 18. And so great for them. They're already established. Let's try it on tour. But for the vast majority of players, I think they are considering college as a viable option.
Good. Good answer. I just think you look at this every way. You look at it in terms of life experience. You look at it as a financial decision. I just can't figure out why you wouldn't at least go for a year like Noah Rubin did or 2 years or 3 years like you did.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I agree with you because that's the path I took. I mean, there was no way Stanford would have let me within 100 miles of their campus if I hadn't played tennis there. So I knew that my tennis was going to afford me incredible opportunities if I chose to go to school. So I made that investment, and I think I'm going to be really thankful for that after my tennis career.
I'm gonna segue here to a random one, but I did a story many moons ago, and we've stayed in touch. He's a great guy. We stayed in touch with a basketball player, Baron Davis. Went to Crossroads.
Yeah.
He went to Crossroads and spent half the interview telling me Crossroads stories about who got picked up in a limo and who was in his class, but then got casted and had to go to New Zealand. That is your high school as well. Give me your best Crossroads story.
Oh, man. You know, I spent so little time there, I can barely tell you.
You didn't have
any... I had like a modified schedule. So I was going to school 8 to 12 and all of that was just classroom time. And then I was leaving at lunch to go train for 6 hours. So I was not on campus as much as I would have liked to be, but it was just crazy the density of just famous people who were at the school. I think like Glenn Frey's kid was the year below me and Julia Louise Dreyfus's kid was in one of my dad's English classes. My dad actually taught there as well. So it was just crazy. Like you'd be on campus and see a different celebrity every day. There was a Jack Quaid, Dennis Quaid, and Meg Ryan's kid was also in my grade. And, you know, I went on my like senior year retreat with him. So it was just like crazy in that sense. It was very Hollywood.
I should have said Crossroads is sort of the choice high school for Hollywood types. I'd heard the story that, you know, Goldie Hawn would be sitting next to, exactly like you said, Dennis Quaid and Goldie Hawn would be sitting next to each other at the, you know, at the recorder recital. I didn't know, did your dad still teach there?
He doesn't. He followed my mom out to Iowa where she got a job. So he's a little bit miserable living in that climate again, but, I think they'll make it back out to LA eventually.
Whoa. I did not know. Your folks live in Iowa now?
Yeah, they live in Iowa, and I'm actually awful. They've lived there for a couple of years, and I have not yet made it to visit, which is, like, terrible. They've been out to L.A. several times, so I feel like I am getting my brownie points seeing the family, but I really need to make it out. I'm going to make a point of that this coming year.
Watch how I do this transition. So speaking of Iowa, I wanted to ask you about Madison Keys, who lives in the Quad Cities, right on the Iowa border.
Yes.
Who,
yes.
I don't know if you saw the story last week that she had the, you know, she's taken up this cause of anti-bullying. And I think a lot of this is sort of cyberbullying,
you know,
and bullying on social media.
I saw the headline. I didn't open the article yet. I was planning to read it this week, though.
Very nice story. And it's, you know, this is, as initiatives go, this was a new one, but I think it's sorely needed. Is this something that you deal with? I mean, I'm always amazed by how people show me that the social messages that athletes get, even, you know, athletes that lose matches in tennis. And is this something you deal with, that you get these horrible messages when you don't win matches?
Yeah. I mean, virtually daily. Like I got a message like 3 days ago. I didn't even play yourself. I didn't play or anything. And it said, kill yourself. So it's just like these things stream in like semi-regularly. And I think if you don't view it with humor or kind of just disregard it, it can be very toxic to your psyche, obviously. But it is a really big problem, I think, because it's this very unregulated world in which people can basically just say whatever they want to you, and they know that at some level they're getting to you, and it's really hard to find a way around that other than like outsourcing your social media and saying, you know what, I don't want to deal with this, so I'm going to have my agent run my account or something like that. But I don't want to do that personally because I like being authentic with my positive fans. But there are days where it's very challenging and you almost just don't even want to have a public appearance on social media just because of all of the negativity and hate mail that you get.
What do you think? You think it's just someone now has a way to connect with you that they didn't have 5 years ago? Or do you think the other theory I've heard is that these are people that are gamblers and have,
yeah,
wagered money on your matches?
100% the majority are losing money betting on you holding serve at 5-4 or something like that. So when that doesn't happen, they lose $1,000 or something on the match, then they just want to, you know, write these terrible things about you. But it just occurs to me as so immature and just I can't really wrap my head around what would possess someone to sit behind a keyboard and write some of the things that I've received. Like, you wouldn't even, I can't even talk about some of the things that have been written to me. It's like every word in the book, every four-letter word, every death threat that you can imagine, they just roll in with semi-frequency. And it really does feel unfair sometimes because it's like you can't control it. You can't really fight back. You can like block these people, but for every one you block,
right,
there are going to be 10
right.
more. So it's just a little bit out of control.
It also strikes me, you're 23 years old and clearly well-adjusted and spent 3 years at Stanford. If you're 17 years old, and it might be a little bit of a different equation. It seems like you I mean, it seems like it bothers you, and you're clearly self-possessed. I can't imagine getting, you know, I can't imagine getting social media messages like that when I was 17.
Well, you have to imagine also that it's in all of your absolute lowest moments that you're getting the majority of these messages. There are some rare events where someone will bet against you, and so when you win, they'll try to tear you down, but that's more just like, that's hilarious, you know, because it's like,
you can't make
me feel bad right now, no matter
you really
how,
got
how
me.
You try. Yeah, exactly. Oh, bummer that you think I'm this word and that word. But the tough thing is when, you know, you have a really tough match and maybe out of a sense of, okay, well, I'm not just going to post things when I win. I want to be like, you know, open with my fans or something like that. You open your social media and you have all this hatred kind of filtering in, like when you're in this moment of kind of vulnerability, that's when it's really, really problematic, I think. And it bears noting that it is definitely not just in the sports world or not just in the tennis world specifically. Like I was just listening to the radio this morning and Ryan Seacrest was talking about how Selena Gomez had to get rid of her phone for 3 months because she was just so like depressed from the toxicity of social media and like all these people who wanted to say mean things about her. So this is not local to tennis. It's really a pervasive problem.
But it strikes me as, I mean, so I don't know if you saw Leslie Jones, for example, someone else on Saturday Night Live just had a brutal social media experience. But I feel like the fact that yours is, it goes to the nature of what you do. So it's not just these ad hominem attacks, but they're attacks about your profession, I think, is a different dynamic than just Ryan Seacrest, you suck, or so-and-so, you're ugly. But is WTA doing
anything?
Yeah, no,
I totally agree. And there are definitely moments in which, you know, maybe your forehand felt shaky in the match and someone was like, you know, writes on your account, like, wow, you literally can't hit a forehand to save your life. You should pick up another profession. You're like, wow, maybe they're right. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, there's
no, that's
definitely
my point.
That
exactly.
Moment of like, that's a little too real.
Right. I mean, I'm like you. I don't know what one does about this, and I don't know if the WTA is. I don't know what can be done here, but
I don't know what they can really do. Yeah,
this is not something your four bears
have
to deal with.
In my opinion, one of the things that can be done, it's really disturbing to me when I go to a professional tennis tournament and it's sponsored by one of these betting sites that I know my like social media traffic is coming from. After I take a bad loss, like that's a little bit unsettling to me sometimes. I hate seeing betting sites being marketed as like a title sponsor or, you know, one of the principal sponsors that's plastered all over a WTA event. I don't like that. I think that sends the wrong message. It's like, hey, participate in this thing that's making people so angry at their player, at our players, that, you know, they're abusing them online. I think that's one way to abate the cycle. But then again, you know, money talks. So it's a little bit difficult to just say, you know, cut out the entire betting industry as sponsors. But for me, that's the only thing that really jumps out as being a little bit weird.
I'll throw this one at you, as long as you brought it up. What about the fact that if you patronized one of these betting sites, you might be banned? You've basically... Players, media, coaches often have to sign vows saying they will not wager on matches by the very same companies that are sponsoring the tournament. Go figure.
Yeah, no, I think there's a tangible amount of irony to that.
I'm tangibling that irony. All right, let me ask you about your social media account, because you've used it to great effect and great entertainment, but you also used it, of course, in advance of the presidential election here. You did not sponsor. you were not supportive of the... the man who is our president-elect. Where are you in sort of the stages of grief?
You know, I think in the days after the election, my main goal was to kind of take it with maturity and say, okay, you know, it's done. What can we do now to be proactive and have a role in government that extends just beyond who our president-elect is? However, in recent days, with some of the appointments to higher office, along with like Steve Bannon and Ben Carson and a number of other characters that I also would not have been casting votes for. I have been continually kind of disillusioned with what I think this presidency is going to mean. However, I reject the idea of just kind of giving up because, you know, your presidential cabinet is not what you want it to be. I think in order to be an effective citizen and an effective participant of democracy, you have to make sure that you're still voicing your opinions and voting on things that extend beyond presidency. So that's kind of where I am right now.
What does that mean in practical terms for you?
In practical terms, I think that means for me, at least, getting involved with causes that I believe in. I tweet, not that tweeting really matters for anything, but I tweet a lot about causes like Black Lives Matter, equality for women. And I really do want to get more and more engaged in those kind of like social causes that I care deeply about. So I think that's also going to be a really big off-court goal for me in 2017 is like, okay, you know, I've been able to talk the talk, so to speak, but let's really put some weight behind some of the things I'm saying and invest some of my time and energy into really investing in what I believe to be right.
Are you worried that comes at a price to your tennis?
No, I don't. I think, you know, my agent would prefer I didn't talk about politics at times. Obviously, there are certain brands that might be put off by the fact that I'm polarizing or, you know, some fans might not respect me because they don't share my political views. I think there's no need for me to be hyper specifically political now that this election is over. Obviously, I care deeply about trying to get Hillary Clinton elected as the first woman president. And so I felt it would have been inauthentic not to be kind of vocal about her and her campaign. But now I think there's a way for me to toe the line a little bit more where I focus more on social justice causes and a little bit less on who said what in politics. And just really, you know, ultimately I genuinely believe that being authentic to myself and working on things that matter to me outside of tennis actually helps my tennis because it inspires me and makes me feel like more of a full person who's contributing to society at a greater level than just knocking some yellow balls around the court.
I can't tell you how often I hear that of players who have other interests who do that like you do, who do things like writing or take on social issues or want to do crossword puzzles just because they feel as though they need to do something more than run around these rectangles hitting fuzzy balls. Is that something?
Yeah, no.
I mean, what's the nature of that?
Go ahead.
I mean, where does that, what do you think the, I mean, I think, you know, you talk the balance is I can't spread myself too thin and this is my athletic career and I can't be juggling 100 balls and I have to remember what it is that is sort of I do for a living. But, It also seems to me more than ever, there's this real urge to diversify and to have interest in other pursuits and do things that don't have to do with tennis. Is that the nature of the sport? Is there, I mean, what do you think is going on there?
Yeah, so I'm not sure what it is for other people, but I know for me, I've always been such a huge proponent of balance. And I think that's why I stayed in school so much longer than the majority of my peers is I just really believed that I had more to offer than just, you know, athletic ability. And maybe that's because I wasn't as talented as like a Sloane Stephens. And so maybe it was like subconsciously hedging my bets and making sure I have other things to fall back on. But I actually think that it's a little bit more proactive than that. It's like, you know what? I'm going to be really good at this one thing, but I want to be good at other things too. And I want to feel like a full person. And I want to go to bed knowing that I'm giving my best to the world. And, you know, at the end of the day, sports are incredible and they're a microcosm for life, but it can also be a really empty pursuit if you don't tie it to meaning off the court. Ultimately, what do I do for a living? I run around and hit tennis balls across a net. I mean, as fun as that is and as fun as it sounds, there's not a whole lot of substance to it sometimes. Obviously, you come through incredible matches sometimes where you show a lot of heart and a lot of grit, and I live for those matches. But there are other times where you're really not feeling like you're offering anything tangible. And I think that's why I have always put so much emphasis on balance, having a social life outside of the tennis courts, having an intellectual life, expressing my opinions, whether political or social justice related. Like, it just helps me to feel a little bit more whole sometimes.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I was looking at your schedule. I was looking at your results before, and it strikes me sort of the wild swings. The same way you talk about your career, it seems there are sort of wild swings in the scale of what you're doing. So one week it's you're playing Grand Slams and there's a lot of money at stake and these are big fancy venues. And then the next week you could be playing for significantly less money. I mean, I think you played French Open, then you played an event where you won $800, and then you were at Wimbledon. What are those swings?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
I've been looking even at your fall schedule, and you're playing in major cities of the world and some not major cities, and you're playing for high stakes and suddenly not high stakes. Especially given your sense of perspective and balance, how do you deal with that? And how, I mean, I'm just analogizing that to other professions where, you know, you're at huge, huge stakes, lawsuits and litigation, and the next week you're in small claims court. I mean, how do you deal with those swings in scale? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. I think there are definitely some letdowns in the year that you have to manage. Obviously, the week after a Grand Slam, you're not going to be playing another Grand Slam. So you're going to be going to a much smaller venue, likely much smaller prize money, unless you do exceptionally well. So you definitely have to manage that. I think the most important thing is to not hyper-focus on what points or viewership or money is available at a tournament. Easier said than done, obviously. But you have to maintain like a consistent trajectory. And for me, what makes me motivated every single week is knowing that I'm adhering strongly to a process that is going to pay dividends at the big events. You're not going to come out and play well at the big events if you haven't been putting in the work the rest of the year. So that's kind of the perspective I take is, you know, all these matches that I'm playing, that feel like nobody's watching and there are no points on the line and there's no money on the line. Those are helping me to get to a place with my tennis where I'm able to perform under huge amounts of pressure with huge money on the line. So that's kind of the way I have to manage it.
You sound entirely too rational to be a professional athlete. let's close here. 2017 is a good year for Nicole Gibbs if blank. I mean, what are you looking forward to? What's going to determine success in the next 12 months?
This is going to be so boring, so it's almost a bummer to end on. But honestly, it's just if I've committed to the things that are going to make me into a better tennis player in the long run. So for me, that means hitting the ball harder, taking more time away, finishing more points at the net. I really think that if I commit to the things that my coach and I are working on, the sky is the limit for me. I want to see myself into the top 20, and then I want to see where I can go from there.
You got to get back to writing. Can I nag you?
Yeah. I think, honestly, that's another part that would make 2017 successful. At least I'm sure the WTA site would think so, because they've been asking me if I'm ever going to write again. I'm like, I'm not sure.
We're going to nag you. This is the editor in us. Get back to writing.
Oh, okay.
get that laptop cooking. This was fun. Thanks. Thanks so much. We'll see you in Australia. Enjoy these next few weeks, and let's see what happens in 2017.
Thanks so much for having me. It was fun.
Take care. Thanks. All right. Special thanks to Nicole Gibbs. Very nice conversation. That's a player to root for. That's a player to follow on social media as well. Unless you're one of those trolls. That's this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. I'm John Wertheim. Our producer, as always, is Jamie Lasanti. We'll do one or two more of these for 2016 and then shut it down before starting up in advance of the Australian Open. Keep the suggestions coming. They're always welcome. We try to accommodate as many of those as possible, especially when tennis gets back in swing and players are a little more accessible. We will take more of those into account. But again, special thanks to Nicole Gibbs, and we'll be back in 7 days. All right, have a good week, everyone.